What is happening, team? Coach Ishak with HockFit Coaching and Legion Athletics, and your host for today's episode of Anabolic Radio. Do I have quite a treat for you all? Today, I'm joined by Alan Aragon, the real, the only. How are you doing today, Alan?
I'm doing so great. You know, I've been calling you Ishak in my mind. Is that inaccurate?
I don't really have a preference, but you could call me Hawk. You could call me Ishak. You could call me Ishak. That's how it's pronounced in Arabic, though, is Ishak.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. And then Hawk Fit is the name of my coaching brand. So it's like a play on words. But yeah, man, did you get your first protein feeding of the day in Stimulate Maximize MPS?
I actually did. And it's nice. very rare that I do a podcast and am able to say that, because as we spoke a little bit, I'm not necessarily a morning person unless we're talking 2 or 3 in the morning. So I got my protein in before we talked. So we're good.
Nice. Are you training today?
I am training today. Oh, and by the way, thank you so much for having me on. And yes, I am training today in the afternoon. So yeah, it's going to be a good day.
What are you training?
I'm training upper body. And upper so body. That's even better day, even better
you're
day.
You're such a bro, Alan. I wouldn't expect anything less of you.
Oh, of course not. You know, lower body days are just for building discipline and upper body day is just fun.
Every day's lower body day. No, I'm just kidding. Anyways, team. So if you're unfamiliar with Alan, he's pretty much one of the people in the industry that has forwarded or pushed the evidence-based or science-based approach with regards to your nutrition and training. He's on a lot of literature that I've read. So if you're unfamiliar with his work, I definitely recommend you go give him a follow on Instagram, even if you don't read literature. He puts out some good content, and also he cites his sources in some of his posts. So it's something you could definitely gain a lot of value out of, even if you're just trying to, simply learn a little bit more about nutrition or training, or if you, in fact, yourself are a coach or a trainer, is definitely somewhere where you could expand your own knowledge base. Now, for the basis of this episode, we will be talking about everything related to nutrition or within the time frame that we have, because we would be here all day. But we're going to be talking about things along the lines of basic nutrition, being in a calorie deficit, the nuances to that. And we will be talking a bit more about protein and optimizing your pre and post-workout nutrition and nuances of nutrient timing. So it's going to be a juicy episode. And to start this off, Alan, it's very common in the industry for people to just parrot what each other says without really having a more comprehensive understanding as to the variables at play. And a very common example is people screaming and shouting, calorie deficit, calorie deficit, calorie deficit. So we know that a calorie deficit is one of the most important variables for fat loss. However, there are other variables that go into a nutritional system to allow someone to achieve an average calorie deficit over time. That being, basics of macros, macronutrient proportion in specific amounts, things like spacing your food out appropriately throughout the duration of the day, getting a sufficient amount of fruits and vegetables in, or micronutrients. So it's more than just focusing on calories and getting those calories in, because what we fulfill those calories through is really important, because what happens when food hits our mouth is different than what happens when it hits our bloodstream. And it's also very important to just like for a general population person to hear calorie deficit, calorie deficit, calorie deficit. That doesn't really help much when the message which we should be sending is, okay, maybe try to build habits and learn behaviors to help you achieve an average calorie deficit over time. So Alan, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this topic. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the nuances of it and people just simply parroting things.
Yeah. Yeah. The term calorie deficit doesn't mean a whole lot to, to people who aren't versed in these concepts. And so a lot of the general public, if you say, you need to run a calorie deficit for the general goal of weight loss, they'll be like, calorie deficit. Okay. What does that mean? Eat very little, right? Just really try to restrict what I'm eating. Okay. I'll try that. And then they run it for a few weeks and they can't stand it. And then they go looking for the next diet. So, the goal of weight loss, there's a different set of focuses and a different set of objectives, depending on the actual population you're talking about, depending on the goal. So everything's going to be goal dependent. You're going to have soccer moms and soccer dads who are weekend warriors and they just want to get halfway back to their college shape, you know? And then you've got, bros like maybe you and me who are at a certain level and we want to fine tune. So there are worlds of difference between those two populations and how you need to communicate the various directives. So I think that it really just begins with, okay, what's the goal? What's the population and what are the stakes? So once you establish those things, then you can begin to talk about guidelines.
Great response. Now, you specifically said weight loss. However, we know that weight loss and fat loss are two different terms, whereas one is a super broad term and the other is much more specific. Now, for changes in body composition to occur, we know that that's far more complex than simple changes that occur in scale weight. So for the general population, a lot of people are unfamiliar with the concept of body recomposition, which is simply building muscle and losing body fat at the same time. So in my opinion, whenever I'm working with a client, and in my experience, I've been doing this for a while, those of you who are tuning in, those of you who have worked with me and you've seen the results we've achieved, I mean, it's very important to really ensure that your internal health is in a position to even be in a calorie deficit in the first place and improve your level of education so that you understand what you need to be focusing on before you go jump in a calorie deficit and you're not able to maximize your efforts. So, Alan, could you give some general guidelines for our anabolic listeners for body recomposition to occur?
Yeah. In the beginning, there is a kind of a sort of the seesaw relationship, kind of the sliding scale seesaw relationship between somebody's training status and their capacity or their potential to experience recomp. So the closer you are to being an overweight or overfat beginner or a overweight, overfat, formerly conditioned person, like an ex-athlete who spent the last 10 years sitting at a desk and raising a family and building a business, let's say, the closer you are to that population, then the greater your capacity to experience recomp or the simultaneous loss of body fat and gain in muscle. Now, the closer you are to somebody who is lean and highly developed in terms of muscle mass, the closer you are to that end of the spectrum, then the less capacity for recomp that you have. So recomp is not entirely, but largely a function of beginning training status and beginning body composition status. So when you take a novice who has extra body fat and you just put them on a program, you don't necessarily have to focus on energy balance or imposing a negative caloric balance in order to try to see favorable results. You get somebody straight off the couch, you have them eating decent and you have them training progressively, they're going to gain muscle and they're going to lose fat at the same time, but over time at a diminishing rate. And it's really interesting when you look at the literature, recomp can even happen in non-beginners. It can happen in intermediates who are relatively lean. So when I'm saying relatively lean, I'm talking about guys who are in their mid-teens, body fat percentage wise. So mid-teens to high teens is what the majority of the recomp and intermediates, the research on that particular population, that's what it shows. And it is really interesting where you can actually not be in a caloric deficit and you can even be in what has been programmed as even a slight surplus. But if you got the extra body fat to lose and you have a certain level of deconditioning or a certain margin of further training status or advancement to fulfill, then you can experience this magical recomp phenomenon. So it is kind of a mind-blowing thing. And it really has nothing to do with net caloric surplus or net caloric deficit. It can happen independently of that. But I want to kind of reel things back to the fact that if somebody has a substantial amount of body fat to lose, and there is a long-term plan, let's say they have enough body fat to try to lose over a 6 month to 12 month period, it's not going to happen unless you program a net caloric deficit by the end of each week and string a bunch of weeks together to get it done. So the closer somebody is to their potential, the more important it is to focus on one goal versus another, versus a stark beginner straight off the couch, you know, nice and fluffy. Then you can just have them focus on train progressively, eat sensibly, and let's watch the magic happen for a while.
Mm. Great points. Yeah, I think a lot of people underestimate their ability to recomp, and even to a greater degree if they're fueling themselves sufficiently, right? Not starving themselves, consuming a sufficient amount of protein, really ensuring that their nutritional protocols are aligned in what is recommended in the literature for allowing body recomposition to occur. And for those of you that didn't, you know, catch too much of what he is saying, you know, basically body recomposition, building muscle and losing body fat could occur as a result of endogenous sources, meaning your internal fat stores, meaning you could lose body fat and build muscle, or exogenous sources, meaning your diet, meaning you could only gain fat and build muscle. So it's really important to have this objective understanding in the background. And Alan, great question for you. Would you say that, you know, we just previously spoke about how, you know, as you climb with regards to your training level of advancement, there's a diminishing return with how much you're able to recomp. However, would you say someone is able to recomp to a greater degree if what they're doing from a program design perspective was not, quote unquote, optimized, and they were not taking into consideration things like biomechanics and strength profiles for muscles and resistance profiles for exercises?
Yeah, it can still happen. It can still happen. They just have to train hard, put in the effort, and make sure that they are just continually progressing in terms of their amount of sets, reps, load. And a lot of times there will be peripheral things that need to be considered and in place, like getting enough rest, recovery, sleep. You and I were talking about Chris Barraquette's work in this area, and he's done some great work, and he's got a paper specifically on recomp. I wish it was one of those open access deals, but you know, if you dig enough for it, you'll get your hands on it. Recomp typically happens observationally anyway when people's protein intake is high. So right around the 1 to 1.5 grams per pound area is where we see the magic happen. And as long as training is progressive, and as long as the energy balance isn't aggressively hypo or hypercaloric, with some exceptions we can talk about, then recomp can happen in folks who are decently far from their potential for muscle gain and fat loss. And I'd have to say one of the things that people can try, that some more from intermediates and up can try to force recomp, is to maintain a net eucaloric balance or just an even balance, and base the surplus that you attempt to impose. Make sure the surplus is not terribly aggressive. Just keep it in the 250-ish calorie, 500 at most, and base it mostly on protein and keep the training progressive. And then that's where we can kind of force a bit of recomp in even in intermediates. But that would be just some some programming generalities that we can target for recomp, in addition to getting enough sleep and getting enough recovery. So it's odd, you know, the bringing up the concept of recomp, it can confuse people and it can frustrate people, because a lot of folks think that that recomp is a thing that they can target, when I have to emphasize that recomp is really sort of a default result of your training status and your bot and your starting body composition status. Now, with that said, you can take a relatively, I'm not going to say advanced, but an experienced trainee, and they've been training a certain way for a number of years and they have a decent amount of muscle mass and they're relatively lean. But if you just optimize their program more, their training programming more, and you optimize their nutrition better, let's say increasing their protein, and you add a little help, like either something that works like creatine or a little something more than creatine, then you'll see recomp in more advanced dudes. So there's different levels to it.
What would you have to say to the deniers of recomp?
To the deniers of recomp, really just look at the data on I would refer anybody.
Look at the data. Science don't lie.
Look at the data. Look at the numbers. It's quite incredible how you'll even see greater lean mass gains than fat loss, which would indicate at least a eucaloric balance, you know, if not a slight hypercaloric balance for the period that recomp occurred. It's really fascinating stuff. None of us would have really embraced this and believed this until we saw the data, which really only rolled out within the last decade or so.
Great points.
And thank you, Chris, for compiling that stuff.
Shout out to Chris.
Shout out to the homie.
Shout out to the homie. Yeah, Habibi. Okay.
And so, I promise I will spell your name correctly from every publication forward, Chris.
You heard it here first, Chris.
Okay. Man's got a wild last name, so.
Bear Cat.
Yeah.
I always remember it as Bear, like a bear. Mm-hmm. And a cat. Bear Cat.
Oh, excellent. I'm going to need that mnemonic device because I keep thinking of Baccarat.
That's like how I have
Baccarat from, like, yeah. So never mind.
That emoji saved in my phone. Okay, so we chatted a little bit about protein and how that's very important to take into account. So general recommendation for protein exceeds the RDA for those who are trying to maximize muscle gain at 0.8. This is a conversion for my metric friends. 0.8 grams of protein all the way up to 1.2 grams of protein per pound of body weight. However, I like calculating that based on off lean body mass, because a 250-pound individual is not going to be consuming 250 grams of protein because they don't have that much lean tissue to support that high of a protein intake. Anyways, so we know that protein is very important if our goal is to recomp. We know that it plays a huge role in maintaining positive protein balance, which we're going to talk about. And you in the 2017 position stand by the ISSN, not only are these guidelines, you know, summarized for those of you who want to check it out, but there's also a paper that I wanted to talk to you about. I believe you're familiar with it, but it's Jose Antonio's paper on higher protein intakes. And basically they had two groups. One group was consuming 800 calories in excess from protein. And the other group was more or less at maintenance. And the group that was consuming excess protein, you know, demonstrated that gains in lean body mass were the same between both groups. However, fat gain between the higher protein group, I'm summarizing it, playing it. Maybe you know it a bit better, but I know that it was something to allude that higher protein intakes in periods of gaining could potentially be beneficial for minimizing excess fat gain and maximizing lean tissue gain. Could you help our anabolic listeners understand some of the mechanisms behind that and why higher protein intakes are beneficial?
Yes. Yes, it's a very interesting area of study where Joey, I call him Joey. I learned that one from Brad. where Joey overfed. It's actually Joey and Anya. Anya Ellerbreck is the kind of the right-hand woman there in the protein research realm. And they overfed subjects up to 800 calories a day, above and beyond maintenance, in the form of just protein. So that is truly fascinating, that 800 calories of protein a day just seemingly disappears. So body composition in resistance trainees — we're not talking about people who are just noobs and untrained, we're talking about resistance trained subjects — have them continue their habitual programs. They're like college athletes and recreational athletes, and then just stack protein on top of a pre-existing sufficiency of intake. So their baseline protein intakes were about two grams per kilogram of body weight. So pretty close to a gram per pound of body weight with their protein intake. And when you add an extra 150 grams of protein on top of that, fascinatingly, it just kind of disappears. And keep in mind that this was seen in free living conditions. And we'll talk about the potential applications. But first of all, how did this disappearance happen? Well, first of all, there's always the possibility of underreporting, or the possibility of misreporting. And when you're talking about free living conditions where you're not confining the subjects to a metabolic ward and putting them under surveillance 24/7. So there's always a degree of either purposeful or accidental non-compliance when you're trying to have subjects run a particular program for a research project. So always a chance. Now, there's interesting things about misreporting depending on the type of food. So generally speaking, subjects in a research study will overreport the healthy stuff and underreport the unhealthy stuff. So they will overreport the amount of proteins they take in, and they'll underreport the amount of carb-fat combination gut bombs that they intake, right? Mm-hmm. So the same things can happen with Antonio's research. Joey told me that people regularly kind of complained about the amount of protein that they were assigned to take in, because it was 4.4 grams per kilogram of body weight, which is roughly 2 grams of protein per pound of body weight, which can be a pain in the butt to maintain for 8 weeks straight. But they gave it their best shot. No changes, no significant changes in body composition for this particular population. So possible reasons how that could happen. Number one, misreporting to a certain degree. Number two, increase in energy expenditure through some pathway, whether exercise related pathway or non-exercise related increases in energy expenditure. So the it is possible that they just took that incoming energy and put that power to the ground, so to speak, in their training bouts. And it is possible that they could have increased subconscious or spontaneous physical activity from the extra protein that came in that would have negated changes in body mass. And the third possibility would be an increase in excretory energy. So they either peed out or pooped out a certain degree of the protein energy that they tried to force down. And there's also an increased thermic effect of the diet, but mathematically that wouldn't necessarily work out as a wash. If you think about it, you're just adding more calories. And even if it's got a certain metabolic cost of processing, it's still going to be a net increase. So it could be a combination of all of those things that made the protein disappear. So there is research by another guy named Bray, who did escalating protein feedings, imposed this on subjects in a metabolic ward. And so he fed them up to about 3-ish grams per kilogram of protein. per kilogram of body weight in protein. And the net caloric surplus was 800-900 calories. And they did gain body fat in addition to lean body mass. But this was under non-exercising conditions in overweight and obese subjects in a metabolic ward where every bite was controlled and surveilled. And so, okay, that's cool data and everything, but we don't live in metabolic wards. And there are interacting variables in free living conditions that are going to dictate what happens with results in the real world. And there's at least four studies now in free living conditions where subjects were overfed protein. So above and beyond maintenance conditions, they consumed anywhere from like 3-ish to 4-ish grams per kilogram of body weight in protein, and no significant changes in body composition over time in resistance trainees. So we can take that data and use it towards dieters who need a break from restricting. So you need a break from restricting? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, go lean protein for this day. You can, you know, have at it. Eat ad libitum or as desired in terms of lean protein. And what will happen is a spontaneous reduction in the intake of the non-protein macros, the non-protein calories, and potential increases in satiety. And those increases in satiety can kind of linger. There will be a decrease in variety and palatability of the diet. So that kind of safeguards against you overeating total calories when you just have like a protein day, for example. And
protein day.
Yeah, protein day. Eat just protein, eat however much you want, see what happens. And people won't eat three whole turkeys that day. You know what I mean? There's just a self regulating, self-limiting quality about eating relatively lean protein. And that's kind of what was that's definitely what was consistently seen in Antonio et al.'s research, where they fed people 400 to 800 calories of just protein on top of their existing maintenance and saw either no change in body composition over time or actually a favorable change in one study on women. They actually recomped, and they were athletes. And so the recomp was evident in this female athlete population who was assigned to eat roughly about 3 grams per kilogram of body weight in protein. So yeah, very interesting stuff.
Wow, that was a beautiful summary. Thank you for that.
Yeah, sure.
So we previously spoke about protein turnover. So for those of you that are unfamiliar, protein turnover is a process that occurs in the body. We basically have two states to this phase. We have a phase where we're literally in a positive net balance, or we're synthesizing amino acids, or we're in a positive muscle protein synthesis state. And then there's muscle protein breakdown, also referred to as muscle protein degradation. And this is the state that we want to try to least avoid if our goal is to maximize hypertrophy or muscle building. So Alan, for our anabolic listeners, could you give them some insight as to the mechanism of protein turnover, muscle protein synthesis and breakdown, and why it's important to have a protein feeding of at least 30 to 40 grams every 3 to 4 hours, which is, you know, in alignment with the current evidence-based recommendations?
Yeah, this is definitely where we start off with what is the goal and what is the population and what are the stakes at hand. So if we're talking about, let's say, the soccer mom, soccer dad who wants to lose 20 to 40 pounds of body fat, they'll say body weight, but we know body fat. And you're going to be kind of by default running hypocaloric conditions, then this protein distribution pattern that we're talking about now, that kind of takes a way, way, way far backseat. But if we're talking about recreational to even competitive athletes who have some training experience and who are actively trying to maximize rates of muscle growth. That's when we need to pay attention to protein intake and the distribution of that protein intake through the day. So you mentioned protein turnover being the cycle of muscle protein synthesis and muscle protein breakdown. We have to basically impose a net gain in muscle protein synthesis over time. So synthesis has to outweigh breakdown over time. And the one way that we can do that is by maximizing the so-called anabolic effect of each meal that we consume through the day. And on top of that, we also can try to maximize the number of anabolic spikes or microanabolic events through the day in order to maximize the accumulation of muscle protein gains through the course of the day, course of the week, course of the month, course of the year. So what we're trying to do is just optimize and maximize. And there are a couple of ways to do that. So the most important way to do that is by hitting your total daily protein intake. So that's number one. And I'm sure that a lot of your listeners kind of have an idea what that might be. And of course, there's avenues that we can go down, because in the literature, for the most part, protein recommendations are listed as amounts per unit of total body weight. And that assumes a normal body weight and a kind of a moderate body fat level. But, you know, that can be problematic if you're talking about extremes on the overweight side and even extremes on the underweight side. So I just kind of want to get that little caveat out of the way. But generally speaking, protein intakes to maximize muscular gains are going to be right in the neighborhood of a gram per pound, or a little bit less in some cases, and a little bit more so, but right around a gram per pound. And if we were to nitpick and point to the literature, we can point to a meta-analysis that I collaborated on with Rob Morton and Stu Phillips and others, where we found a range of 1.6 to all the way up to 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight would be kind of the sweet spot or the range that maximizes muscle growth.
Would you say it's safe to just basically provide a summary based on total daily protein intake and the distribution of that within each meal, rather than just like a blanket statement, oh, 40 grams, you know? We know that's enough to stimulate it, but let's get more accurate about it.
Yes, there's definitely this hierarchy of importance that we have to keep in mind. So number one on the hierarchy would be total daily protein intake by the end of the day. And if you're getting that 0.7 to 1.0 grams per pound, or, you know, 1.6, 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight, then you're in the right ballpark. And I usually like to summarize that as just saying right around a gram per pound if you're really trying to push the hypotheticals towards muscle growth. So that's number one. And number two, we can kind of get into the weeds a little bit and speculate over what amount of protein per meal maximizes the anabolic response. When I say maximizes the anabolic response, I'm really talking about what maximizes muscle protein synthesis. And so this has been a debate and an area of just kind of discussion and arguing for a couple decades now. And that is largely because we haven't looked at realistic exercise protocols to test until like within the last five, six, seven years. And so prior to very recent research, we had this assumption that 20, 25 grams of protein is going to maximize muscle protein synthesis, regardless of the training bout. So just to back up a little bit, muscle protein synthesis because of a greater muscle protein turnover post-exercise, you can elicit a protein-mediated spike in muscle protein synthesis to a higher degree in the post-exercise state versus in the resting state. So there has been a lot of debate over how much protein in the trained state is going to maximize muscle protein synthesis, because muscle protein synthesis is the short-term marker of anabolism or growth that we can kind of project and speculate that over time we can maximize muscle growth if we can push muscle protein synthesis higher and higher and higher per meal. So what does it take to do that? What is the dose? Now, just recently, 20 grams was compared with 40 grams after a higher volume, a full body resistance training bout. Whereas prior to that, we've only been looking at the protein feeding effects after training the legs for like four to eight sets, you know, with some extensions and some, you know, some presses and then to test muscle protein synthesis. Oh, it tops out at 25 grams. So now this time it indeed topped out at 40 grams instead. And this was in younger subjects. And just adding another wrinkle here, if I can complicate things even more, the ceiling of muscle protein synthesis per meal is higher in older fogies versus the younger whippersnappers. And it's just that younger muscle, or at least a trained muscle, is more sensitive and more receptive to protein feedings than older muscle. Okay, so it takes older guys are slower to warm when you're talking about protein dosing. So looking at the literature as a whole, it appears that about 0.4 grams per kilogram of body weight, which is roughly a quarter of a gram per pound of body weight, is right around the where you would want to start as far as protein dosing per meal. And for most folks, that's going to start at around 30-ish grams, and it's going to top out at around 50-ish grams if you consider some of the higher outliers, older guys who even would require as much as about 0.6 grams per kilogram of body weight in order to maximize the muscle protein synthetic response per meal. So if we want to maximize the anabolic response, we can't just consider the average amount. We have to look at some of the outlying higher ends just so you cover all your bases. So the prudent thing to do for maximizing a distribution of protein intake or optimizing it in order to push growth to the max, what we do is we take a look at, number one, what total amount of protein in the day maximizes muscle growth. Okay, that's right around 1.6 to 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight. Number two, how can we maximize the muscle protein synthetic effect of each meal? And what we would simply do is look at the literature, and it happens to be about 0.4 all the way to 0.6-ish grams per kilogram of body weight. And so when we do the math on that sort of thing, we look at 0.4 to 0.55 or 0.6 and see what is it going to take for those distributions? How many meals is it going to take to equal this magical total daily protein intake range of 1.6 to 2.2? And it's going to take roughly 4 meals to do that. So 4 meals dosed at 0.4 to 0.6 grams per kilogram of body weight and distributed through the day. Ideally, you wouldn't want to cram them into like a 6 hour window. You would want to distribute it through the day in order to not leave these massive gaps. And then you're maximizing your potential there. So it is kind of a complicated set of objectives if you're hearing this for the first time. And so if you are hearing this for the first time, then and you want to kind of learn about this and have it sink in a little bit more, I wrote a paper with St. Bradley Schoenfeld a few years back. And the title of the paper is How Much Protein in a Single Meal maximizes muscle building? How much protein in a single meal? What is the actual title of that? Do you remember? I don't remember the titles of the papers I publish. I'll tell you in a sec. Whenever I just tell people to Google Aragon, how much protein? How much protein? And then
as you're doing that, we okay, know.
I got it. Here we go. Okay. The name of the paper is "How much protein can the body use in a single meal for muscle building?" That's the name of the paper.
So you have the PMID on that?
Oh, the PMID. I actually Googled up the first result is the JISSN.
Oh, okay. Article. Okay.
So okay. Yeah. So yeah, but you know what? Just Google Aragon, how much protein, or Google Schoenfeld, how much protein, and then it'll be the first result in a Google search. And that paper, we go into depth about how much protein can the body use to maximize muscle protein synthesis, and how can we use that information to program stuff in the bigger picture over the course of the day in terms of total daily intake to maximize rates of growth. But it really does kind of boil down to at least four meals dosed at 0.4 to 0.55. I don't know if you can round that up to 0.6 grams per kilogram of body weight per day.
Check out the paper, guys, and put Alan's name. Let's just get him a better SEO rating. And
put some respect on my name, man.
Put some respect on his name. Absolutely. So we know that total daily protein intake is king. And we know that it also depends on the demographic, general population person versus an athlete. Yes. So let's say an athlete who's dieting, would it potentially be more valuable to around our workout window, so pre-workout, to have a protein feeding of at least 30 to 40 grams going into our session, to provide a substrate for oxidation as we're training, right? And then post-workout, it has an ability to maximize, stimulate MPS, kickstart the recovery process. So we know that most people, they should just not stress about getting their post-workout meal in, just get it within at least a three-hour window. It's a large garage door. However, that totally depends on the demographic, right? So if it's an athlete who's dieting at the tail end of a contest prep or in a contest prep, those protein feedings peri-workout have a higher of importance. So would you say that that is fairly sound, although the recommendation in the literature is, 3 to 4 hours, 30 to 40 grams, general recommendation?
Yeah, I think that the higher the stakes and the more physiologically stressful the conditions, and if, especially if you're talking about maximizing the retention of muscle in competitors and athletes, then there's a lot of practical benefit to sandwiching the exercise bout with protein before and then protein after. So, and that would, we're talking about the framing of the so-called peri-exercise period, which that's a different concept, a more valid concept than the post-exercise anabolic window concept, which is very kind of incomplete and outdated. I totally agree with framing the training bout with protein on both sides.
Great response. And now we know that MPS is total intake of protein is important for stimulating, maximizing MPS. However, we know that amino acid scoring of that protein feeding is really important, primarily because leucine is considered as the growth switch or growth stitch. Whatever, potato, for stimulating MPS. Now, this goes even further for considerations for someone who is plant-based or vegetarian or vegan. So how can they manipulate their intake or better include a variety and spectrum of amino acids to help them fulfill a complete chain? What are some recommendations we could give those people? Or not those people, our anabolic listeners that are vegan or plant-based.
All right, now listen, you people. So the first and foremost, at least in hypothetically, people who are strictly plant-based, vegans, they are not going to be on a completely level playing field with omnivores when it comes to protein quality. And protein quality is there's a number of ways to define that, but the proportion of essential amino acids in a given protein source, and within those essential amino acids, the proportion of the anabolic driving amino acids, so the branched chain amino acids, and the most important being leucine. Diet-wise, vegans can simply increase their total protein intake by about 20% above and beyond what omnivores would be eating. Or they can just put the focus on high quality plant proteins that are known to be able to run on the same, a similar playing field with animal proteins. So I'm talking about proteins such as pea protein, soy protein as well, although I have there's some issues and caveats with just consuming soy, isolated soy protein as your main source. So I would lean, like you got tempeh, tofu, even just like
beans,
supplemental soy protein, edamame type stuff. I would issue a little bit of a warning on just totally relying on isolated soy protein. There have been at least some case studies that raise concern of hormonal alterations when people are just slamming down the soy protein isolate. But pea protein has emerged as a pretty as kind of the MVP in the plant protein based world. And there are other proteins coming through. There's mycoprotein, which is a fungus based protein. They're actually seeing yeast.
Nutritional yeast.
Yeah. There's even isolated potato protein is doing good. And then there's blends of the vegan friendly proteins within protein powders, like mixes of pea protein and rice protein. And the amino acid profile of those types of products can come pretty close in quality to things like whey. So for vegans who are wanting to be on at least a decently level playing field with the extraordinary gentleman, the omnivores, if they want to be on a level playing field with gentlemen of culture like omnivores.
No, but, absolutely. I mean, hey guys, I mean, nothing against you if you're vegan or vegetarian, but I mean, we know from fish and especially grass-fed beef, we're getting, you know, essential fatty acids in that as well. So basically, you have to look at your nutrition and you have to try and fill in the gaps that you're not getting through your diet. So whether that be going and getting a good omega-3 or EPA or DHA, or, you know, really ensuring that you're having a variety of protein is really important to ensure that you're just kind of fulfilling the required amount or the appropriate amount of amino acids. And then, you know, total protein intake is king. So long as you're getting a sufficient amount of total daily protein intake, it's nothing to stress about over to a great degree. Would you say?
I would say that's fair. And if you're not willing to increase your total protein intake by 20% above and beyond what maximizes stuff in omnivores, then really kind of cozy up to the idea of a good plant-based protein powder. So you can use that as a great tool in diet programming for vegans. I'm a huge proponent of protein powder, especially for that purpose. And you know, dude, we can talk about the existing research on animal protein versus plant protein in resistance trainees. And thus far, there's a feather in the cap of vegan camp with Lorraine and colleagues who compared a vegan diet with an omnivore diet. First one in the literature to date on resistance training conditions. And there were no significant differences in muscle and strength gain between the omnivore group and the vegan group.
Now we just have to wait for a Netflix documentary to blow that out of proportion.
Well, yeah, that'll definitely happen. That's no doubt about that. But the main caveat with that study is the use of untrained subjects. So whenever you run a study with untrained subjects, their newbie gains can mask actual treatment differences between the, you know, whatever you're imposing on the, in the protocol. So kind of a still a big question mark, in my opinion, as far as that stuff goes, but feather in the cap for Camp Vegan.
Nice. Feather in the cap for Camp Vegan. And with all this sciencey stuff, and, you know, we've been talking a lot about literature and what's summarized in literature, it's very important to be practical with yourselves, guys, right? So, like, we have these guidelines in the literature, but it shouldn't be something that takes away from your quality of living. You have to remember that, you know, this is something that is supposed to improve our quality of living. So if what you're currently doing is stressing you out to a great degree, maybe that's a more of a reason to, or that prompts you to take a step back and look at what you're currently doing and see if it's something that you actually enjoy, right? Remember, it's supposed to add to our quality of living. So it's great to have these body composition related goals, but you also have to recognize the internal health benefits that we obtain from simply just taking care of our health, making sure we're not overeating, or if we are overeating, you know, we do have a deficit thrown in at some period of time. Really ensuring protein, you know, is sufficient is also really important. And, you know, even resistance training is really important. There's a PMID floating somewhere in my head, but I mean, it decreases depression. For females, it decreases bone fractures, and that's especially important if you're a woman because you go through osteoporosis as you age. Resistance training is increasingly important because it improves your bone mineral density. And, you know, I'm sure, Alan, you could agree that there's so many internal health benefits that we obtain from resistance training outside of just looking good. If it was put in a pill, you know, that would be a pill that everyone would be taking. But I guess it's just like the time investment, right? And it's not a priority for some people. There's also even stuff that we think is like, oh, it's so easy. There's barriers to entry. So part of this too is just educating people and breaking down those barriers of entry as well. You know, if you see someone in the gym and you're someone who's more experienced, go fucking say what's up, you know, shoot the shit with them. Compliment them if you see them there consistently, you know, support each other. This is how it should be. Right. It's how we all grow and learn together. Anyways, that was a tangent. Alan, I really want to thank you for your time, man. I genuinely appreciate it. And to round off this discussion, what are some things in the industry that you'd like to see change in the next couple of years?
I would like to see people not be afraid to speculate and propose protocols that are different from what is politically correct within the evidence-based community. Because, you know, nobody's immune to parroting what your tribe says. And everybody wants to be accepted into their respective group, and nobody wants to rock the boat. So... And I know this is a little bit, you know, we can even talk about, the most recent post I've done. It is a training post, and it's about training to failure versus not. And kind of over the last recent years, there's been some momentum about warning against, you don't have to train to failure. You'll get the exact same results. Look at this PubMed, you know. And that has always kind of rubbed me the wrong way when people say you never have to train to failure. It depends on the goal. It depends on the population, you know. And
absolutes. And my head through a wall.
You know. And even with things like veganism, I did another recent post about veganism and its relationship to mental health. So. I think that people need to break away from the narrative of their tribe. So the vegan tribe would say that veganism is the greatest thing ever. It's much more nutritionally superior to omnivorism, and it's much better for your health than omnivorism. And so that's inaccurate. It's just inaccurate. And the risks need to be acknowledged. So it needs to be acknowledged within people in the vegan community that there are risks to veganism. There are common nutritional shortfalls to veganism. There are common essential nutritional shortfalls to veganism. There is the looming risk in a significant proportion of the general public for mental health issues that can be exacerbated by veganism. So people need to acknowledge those things, and it helps to talk about it, because then you can better either facilitate your, if you're trying to help people, or you can better further your agenda, whichever one you're trying to do. So I think that, yeah, that those are some of the things that need to change in the fitness industry. Just being, having the courage to voice an opinion that's different from the collective hive opinion of your given tribe.
Mm. And have the courage to be your unique self. There's too many people trying to copy each other.
Yes.
Be you and embrace your uniqueness. Yep. Man, that was a good round of discussion. Good way to end it.
Yeah, buddy.
All right, guys, go give Alan a follow. And if you enjoyed the episode, be sure to give us a screenshot and tag us on social. Alan, I want to thank you once again for taking the time out of your day to come on and shoot the shit and have the discussion with me.
Ishak, you are a gentleman and a scholar, so I thank you so much for having me on.
Cheers. Thanks. Talk soon. Stay tuned for future episode, guys.